You're climbing through 300 feet above the departure end of the runway, power set, airspeed stable. The ground is falling away below you, and then it goes quiet in a way that no engine is supposed to go quiet. The prop is windmilling and the silence is total. In that moment, you have roughly 3 to 5 seconds to make the most consequential decision of your flying life. Turn back to the runway or commit to what's ahead. I'm Tower. This is ATS on Radio Hangar, and today we're talking about the impossible turn, what it actually takes to survive one, why most pilots have the wrong number in their head, and how you can replace the gamble with a real decision. Today's aviation news is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. Let me start with why it's called impossible. The term has been part of the aviation safety conversation for decades. It refers to the maneuver of turning back to the departure runway after an engine failure on climbout. The name isn't meant to suggest you can never do it. It's meant to suggest that most pilots attempting it at low altitude in a real emergency cannot do it successfully. The accident record bears that out. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, and the Air Safety Institute at the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, or AOPA, have studied this category of accidents extensively. The pattern is consistent. A pilot loses power shortly after takeoff. They identify the runway behind them as the obvious place to be. They initiate the turn, and they either spin in, run out of altitude short of the threshold, or collide with something in the attempt to get back. Fatal accidents involving this decision are not rare. They are a recurring entry in the National Transportation Safety Board's annual general aviation statistics. The problem isn't the maneuver itself. The problem is the altitude. Most pilots attempt the turn with far less altitude than the aircraft needs to complete it safely. And the gap between the altitude the pilot thinks they need and the altitude they actually need is, in most cases, measured in hundreds of feet. Here's the physics, and this part matters. When you bank an aircraft, you increase the load factor. At 30 degrees of bank, you're pulling roughly 1.2 Gs. At 45 degrees, 1.4 Gs. At 60 degrees, 2 full Gs. That increased load factor drives up your stall speed. In a coordinated 45-degree bank turn, your aircraft stall speed is about 40% higher than it is in level flight. That is not a small margin. Now add the fact that you've lost your power source. You're not in a bank turn with the engine helping you maintain altitude. You're in a power-off glide. You're trading altitude for airspeed and airspeed for continued flight. Every second you're in that turn, the ground is getting closer at a rate that surprises pilots who've only ever worked through this in their heads. The geometry adds another layer. The turn back to the runway isn't just 180 degrees. If you depart on runway 27 and initiate a turn to come back and land on 27 from the opposite direction, you need to overshoot your original course to align with the center line. By the time you've traveled enough distance down the departure path that an engine failure actually becomes a problem, the total angular change required to reach the runway threshold can be 210 or 220 degrees. That's a lot of arc at a lot of bank while descending without thrust. So what altitude does it actually take? This is where the research gets specific. And it's worth sitting with these numbers. For a typical general aviation single, something like a Cessna 172 or a Piper Cherokee, the studies consistently show you need somewhere between 800 and 1200 feet above the ground just to have a reasonable chance of completing the turn and arriving over the runway with enough altitude to flare and touch down in a controllable manner. Some aircraft, in some conditions, require more. Here's what makes that number hard to internalize. 800 to 1200 feet above the ground feels like a long way up when you're on departure. The runway is getting small below you, but in a light single at best rate of climb, you might spend 30 to 45 seconds getting to 800 feet. That's a long time to have an engine failure window open behind you. And pilots tend not to think in terms of altitude bands during the departure phase. They're scanning instruments, looking for traffic, cleaning up the aircraft. The conditions that tighten that window even further are significant. Density altitude is the big one. A hot summer day at a high-elevation airport doesn't just reduce your climb rate. It changes the entire performance envelope you're working with during the turn. A field elevation of 5,000 feet on a 90-degree day can mean your aircraft performs like it's at 8 or 9,000 feet standard day. That affects your glide ratio, your sink rate in the bank, and the airspeed at which you'll stall. Aircraft weight is another factor pilots underestimate. A Cessna 172 with full fuel, two average adults, and luggage is a different aircraft than the same airframe with 150 pounds of fuel and one pilot. The heavier aircraft has a higher stall speed in the turn and a higher sink rate in the glide. Your personal return number was established under specific conditions. If those conditions change significantly, the number changes too. Wind completes the picture. A headwind on departure turns into a tailwind when you reverse course. A tailwind extends the distance of your glide relative to the ground, which works against you when you're trying to reach a specific patch of runway. The calculation that seems clean in calm conditions becomes significantly more complex in a 15-knot wind. Let's talk about what AOPA and the Air Safety Institute recommend, and what you can actually do about this. The core recommendation is deceptively simple. Know your number before you go. Not a generic number from a textbook. Not the number from an article about a different aircraft type. Your number in your airplane, on a day that reflects typical conditions for where you fly. The way you find that number is at altitude. Pick a day with good visibility and room to work. Take your aircraft up to 5,000 or 6,000 feet above the ground, establish a normal climb-out attitude with your normal departure power setting, and then reduce the throttle to idle. Simulate the engine failure, make the turn all the way around to the reciprocal heading, and see what altitude you lose in the process. Do this with an instructor the first time. Do it multiple times at different initial altitudes. You're looking for the floor. The minimum altitude at which you can initiate the turn, complete it to a runway heading, and arrive with a margin that would allow you to land safely. That number is yours. It belongs to your aircraft, your typical loading, your typical departure conditions. Write it down. Put it on your kneeboard. Review it during pre-flight. Make it as automatic as your fuel check. Now here's the part of the conversation that pilots sometimes resist. For many aircraft in many conditions, that number is higher than the altitude you'll reach before you're beyond realistic return range. In other words, for many departures, a successful return to the runway is off the table before you've even cleaned up the aircraft. That's not defeatism, that's planning. If your number is 1,000 feet above field elevation and the departure path has obstacles, rising terrain or noise abatement procedures that keep you from climbing at best rate, your actual window for a successful return might be extremely narrow, narrow enough to call it negligible. Knowing that ahead of time is what lets you make a real decision instead of an impulsive one. It's the difference between a rehearsed response and a startle reaction. The alternative, landing straight ahead or into whatever is forward of the aircraft, is not a failure. It is frequently the correct choice. Pilots have successfully managed forced landings into farm fields, parking lots, roads, and even into trees in ways that were survivable because they committed early to a plan that was actually achievable and flew the aircraft all the way to that outcome. There's a concept in the research called the commitment altitude. Below a certain point on departure, if the engine quits, you go straight. You don't deliberate. You've already decided on the ground what that means for your specific departure. You know what's ahead. You've looked at the chart, and you've accepted that a straight or nearly straight path is the survival play below that altitude. That commitment altitude is not fixed. It varies by departure path, by obstacles, by aircraft performance. It can be determined on the ground in about 30 seconds of chart study and a look down the departure corridor, but it needs to be established before you're airborne, because the moment of engine failure is not the time to begin the analysis. Above the commitment altitude, but below your personal return capable altitude, the answer is still usually straight ahead or a gentle modified turn toward a better landing option that doesn't require the full reversal. Only above your personal return altitude, established through your own practice in your own aircraft, does the turn back to the runway enter the realm of realistic options. Some pilots have heard of the 45-degree rule. The idea is that if you can look back over your shoulder at the moment of failure and the runway is within a 45-degree cone behind you, the return is feasible. There's some intuition in it. But the research suggests it's too simplified to stake your life on. Aircraft performance? Weight, density, altitude, your exact airspeed at the moment of failure, the geometry of your specific departure, all of these affect the outcome in ways a glance over the shoulder cannot account for. Use it as a rough sanity check if you must. Do not let it replace the calculation. Let's talk about the mechanics of the turn itself for the pilots who have established that they do have the altitude to attempt it. The first action when the engine stops is to lower the nose to establish best glide. This is not optional and it is not intuitive. The instinct is to hold the nose up because up feels like safety, but an aircraft at best glide is the only version of that aircraft that will give you the maximum time and options. Starve the airspeed chasing altitude and you'll have neither. The bank angle question has a real answer. Steeper bank gets you turned faster, but costs altitude at a higher rate and raises your stall speed into dangerous territory. Shallower bank gives you more time to think, but requires more ground distance to complete the turn, which also costs altitude. The research points to approximately 45 degrees as the optimum for most light aircraft in most conditions, fast enough to matter, not so steep that you're in the danger zone. Your practice turns at altitude should reflect that number. Coordination matters enormously here. A slip in a power-off low-altitude turn is uncomfortable. A skid is potentially fatal. The skidding turn at low altitude with reduced airspeed is one of the classic setups for an incipient spin, and spins at low altitude are not recoverable in the time available. Keep the ball centered. Keep it centered even when your stress response is telling you to do everything faster and harder. Do not extend the flaps in the turn. Some pilots reach for flaps because their training associates flaps with landing, and the brain is doing its best to get ready. But flaps increase drag and can produce an abrupt change in sink rate at exactly the wrong moment. Full flaps go out when you're aligned with the runway and have the runway made. Except that your aim point may not be the approach end numbers, it may be the displaced threshold, it may be the parallel taxiway. It may be a point on the runway that would draw criticism on any other day. Pavement you can put the aircraft onto within a controllable airspeed range is a successful outcome. The AOPA Air Safety Institute has produced significant material on engine failure after takeoff, including scenario-based training modules that walk through the decision tree in a structured way. Those resources are worth your time before you need to apply any of this in an actual emergency. Let me put this in the broader context. The accident record suggests engine failures after takeoff in well-maintained modern general aviation aircraft are relatively rare. The certification standards, manufacturing quality, and maintenance requirements for modern certificated engines have driven that frequency down. But rare is not impossible, and the severity of the outcome when it does happen is directly related to whether the pilot had a plan. The accident reports where a pilot survives a forced landing at low altitude share a common thread. Early decision, commitment to the plan. Flying the aircraft all the way to touchdown. The accidents that produce worse outcomes share a different thread. Late indecision, a partially completed turn that ran out of altitude. An attempt to stretch the glide to a preferred point rather than accepting the best option actually in reach. Fly the aircraft. That phrase appears in almost every emergency training context for a reason. The cognitive load of a surprise engine failure, the adrenaline, the awareness of the proximity of the ground, all of it conspires to make pilots freeze or react impulsively at the moment when deliberate trained responses are what's needed. The answer to that is preparation. Not repetition of the emergency itself, because you can't arrange that, but repetition of the decision and the mechanical response until the decision is preloaded and the response is close to automatic. Think about the departure briefing you do before every flight. 30 seconds of looking at the chart, looking at the departure end, and running through the if-then exercise. At 50 feet, I go straight. At 200 feet, I still go straight. At what altitude does my practice tell me I'm above my personal return number? What's in front of me if the engine stops right now? That briefing is not paranoia. It is the same thing that airline crews do at every departure. The reason they do it is not because they distrust the engines. It is because a loaded decision is faster than a fresh one, and speed matters when altitude is the resource you're working with. The impossible turn is not actually impossible. For some pilots, in some aircraft with the right altitude and the right preparation, it is a viable option. But making it viable requires knowing your number, establishing it honestly through practice, and making a decision before you start the engine about exactly what you will do if the engine stops. AOPA's Air Safety Institute and the National Transportation Safety Board's accident analysis inform most of what you've heard today. RadioHangar.com for more blue skies.